Brown eyes and I were tired. We had walked and we had scrambled through the moors and through the briars, through the endless blue meanders. In the blue August moon, in the cool August moon, over the nights and through the fires, we went surging down the wires, through the towns and on the highways, through the storms in all their thundering. In the blue August moon, in the cool August moon, then we rested in a desert where the bones were white as tinsel, and we saw St. Elmo's fire splitting irons in the ether.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have Miles Harvey here in the studio. And I should say, thanks for being here, everyone on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. Miles, thanks for coming down to the studio. It's a wintry morning. We're taping the show. It's January 16th, 2025. And Miles, we've got your latest book on the table with us. This is Fiction, a collection of stories, the registry of forgotten objects, and winner of the Ohio State University prize, the Journal Nonfiction Prize. And it also, that was just like hot off the press, really, the book, 2024 publishing.
Yeah, it was a real thrill for me. You know, I studied here at the University of Michigan in the MFA program before it was the Zell program a long time ago.
Let's start there.
Yeah, so this was a really transformative experience in my life and certainly my career. You know, I was there from 89 to 91 and studied with some people who are still mentors and friends.
Charlie Baxter,
totally.
Here at that time.
Yeah, and Nick Del Banco.
Yes, yes.
And my colleagues were, I just had a really close group of colleagues who are still dear, dear friends and people I send my work to all the time. Bill Lychak, who's a novelist and a wonderful short fiction writer who teaches at Pitt right now. And Michael Paterniti, who's an amazing nonfiction writer, won the National Magazine Award one year, and Cammie McGovern, who does just about everything. She's written serious fiction. She's written teen fiction, YA fiction. She's written a great memoir. She's just kind of amazing. And so I just really lucked into, I think writing.
And you're still in touch, as you're saying.
Totally. They're totally great friends still. Like, and it's just, one of the things I tell my graduate students at DePaul University, where I teach tea, is be nice to your colleagues.
Because they're your people, right?
I mean, they're the people I trust most with my work, and the people, even sometimes they're wrong about my work, but I know where they're coming from, and I know they always have my best interests in mind. And we just have these, sort of sustaining lifelong friendships, and we're still all really close. I've just, I was out in Minneapolis for Charlie Baxter's book launch, his latest book. And Bill came out too. And I got to be UT. I got at the opening night gala, I got to interview Charlie, which was just such a blast.
So you were up on the stage and having a conversation.
Oh man, it was so fun for me and such a cool honor for me. And
what's the latest book title? It's slipping my mind.
It's called Blood Test.
That's right. Okay.
Yeah, I think,
creepy too, right?
Yeah,
with the future.
so I think what Charlie, what he says he was trying to do, I don't speak for Charlie, but was during COVID, write a funny book. And I think it is really funny, like laugh out loud funny on a lot of pages. But, Charles Baxter being Charles Baxter, I just think it's this amazing social satire, and I just think in some ways, you know, his previous book, The Sun Collective, was also that way, about this cult, mm-hmm. and I thought it was a great novel, but in some ways, I think the funny novel, I think they're kind of a pair. I don't know if Charlie would agree with me, but I think...
You didn't get to this in the conversation.
We didn't. Well, yeah, I might have said it. I can't remember what his response was, so I don't want to speak for him. But I think in some ways, this you know, the funny book is more biting in that way that, you know, Vonnegut's best work can be, where you're laughing, but you're not really laughing.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
And the premise is, you know, is just so absurd and great. It's this Kafkaesque premise. A guy goes in for a, you know, very 25 kind of blood test that once they put it through the computer, they come back with him with this sort of, you know, I don't think he uses the word AI, but AI-generated information that he's going to murder someone. And it goes from there. Like, oh, my blood says I'm going to murder someone. Oh. And what does that mean? And
Worse than phrenology.
Yeah, it, a little bit like that, right? But I think there's a lot of that in our culture now, where notions of technology and fate are becoming intertwined and... Yes. In very odd ways, yeah.
And a weird mix even. I don't know. Do you listen to the podcast Freakonomics?
Sometimes.
Ever, Miles?
Yeah.
Yeah, recently they Dubner had the academic journals sort of under, like, he returned to this study that they had done, this show about people like falsifying, or the data's not right and the journal's still being like... publishing everything, and so it's throwing things also into like a time where we don't need to doubt more, like the universities or the systems in place. I think the journals are in question, and just listening to those two episodes, it made me think, oh, yeah. We got to revisit systems we've got.
I just think there are times, T, when the truth is porous, and I think it has a lot to do with technology. My last nonfiction book was actually a Michigan book called The King of Confidence.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Let's talk brief. I saw an interview with you and Jeremy Chamberlain.
Oh, yeah. Also, I just saw him last night. Yeah.
He did. Yeah. Yeah. At Literati.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you know, this was about a con man / prophet who took his followers in the mid-19th century to Beaver Island in Michigan and declared himself king of earth and heaven. And, you know, it's laughable now, some of this stuff, but the U.S. government took it seriously enough to send in its first iron-hulled warship to invade the island because it had a semi-autonomous state on U.S. soil that was also a pirate colony, by the way. But one of the ways this guy succeeded, it seems so absurd, you know, that he would succeed. But one of the ways he succeeded is he really understood. He was a journalist, among many other things. He really understood media was really changing in that period. And just in dramatic ways, just like our period, there's a whole new paradigm. And he understood how to manipulate national media from Beaver Island in this really amazing and interesting way. And I just think we're at that period now. I mean, AI, as a college teacher at DePaul University, you know, we see it all the time in our classrooms in bizarre ways, not so much in creative writing classrooms, but my literature colleagues see it all the time. And, you know, I think in Registry of Forgotten Objects, it's just someone in your shoes, T, just it was interviewing me about and came and asked about this one story called The Master of Patina, which is about an artist who discovers he can make new objects old, like literally make them ancient. And he said, you know, this makes me think of AI. And I said, you know, I wrote this long before ChatGPT, but it does ask the question, if something is beautiful and makes you and seems to be what you thought it was, and if an object is absolutely something that inspires you, that seems to be completely real and original, is it something beautiful, or is it something that you should feel bad about feeling that it's something beautiful? And I think AI is going to force that question in a lot of different ways.
And sometimes, you know, sometimes like when we think that something could be like smoother or beautiful, it could be because we have some connections to it that means it's easily recognizable, that means it isn't new. It's like, I mean, I think I'm thinking of AI as like this compendium of taking everything that all of us people writing, writers who would do it for professions, their books, their, but people writing whatever they're writing, their essays, and it's just like hoovering it up into it. And then things getting processed over and over, and the things that come back to us, people relying on them, using them again. And then this just the funnel of things that we'll easily connect to because we already know them, instead of something beautiful that has the edges and that has the like dark creativity or whatever the trouble is that can be human.
Yeah, no, and that's exactly right. I'm hopeful that that human connection is what a true experience is about. There's a story in the Registry of Forgotten Objects called "The Man Who Slept with Eudora Welty,"
which I mean, what a title and what a character.
Yeah, ostensibly,
is he Tim Harris or is he?
No. Yeah. I mean, it's totally you know, well, made up. But
let's say, okay, the Registry of Forgotten Objects. Yeah. Let's just get to this book. You say it's totally made up, and I will take you at that at face value, Miles, but so many parts of it you seem to place in a world that may or may not have been very much yours, on a train coming back to the University of Michigan for grad school in an MFA program. Listeners, didn't we just hear about this at the top of the hour, or am I mistaken? And so it's interesting that you say that it feels like you've used an old frame that's nonfiction to create this fiction. But tell us about it, because I wanted to ask you about this story.
Well, so the story is both, like, I don't write autobiographical fiction, and some of my favorite writers do. I mean, I don't think my life is particularly interesting, but of course everything I write, nonfiction and fiction, is in fact autobiographical in some way. And whether there's a memoir element to it or not, or a I voice in the nonfiction. And this piece is very much reminds me of the way I felt as a 29-year-old young person who was trained and practiced and was a practicing journalist who read a lot but didn't have a literature degree, and all of a sudden popped into this, you know, really stimulating graduate creative writing program.
Intensive,
yeah, where everyone knew a lot more, had done a lot more reading than I had. I mean, I think...
Different kinds of reading.
Yeah, different kinds of reading. I think I was pretty widely read then and am now. I think it's one of my things is that I don't sort of zero in. I read widely. So the sort of the character who happens to be a professor of English in his late middle age, early elderly age, whatever... again, much like me, is, you know, sort of looking back on this incident. And this incident where the young writer meets an old man on a train who claims to have had a torrid love affair with the notoriously chaste Eudora Welty didn't actually happen, though I've, like all of us, I've had very weird encounters on Amtrak.
Yes.
And even more on Greyhound buses.
I was just going to say that. Thanks, Miles. Shout out to both.
Yeah. The Greyhound bus. I told my daughter one time when she was taking a Greyhound bus, I'm like, something very disturbing and weird will happen. And she came back and said, yeah, something disturbing and weird happened. But really, this story ostensibly is about, you know, this... narrator character trying to figure out if Eudora Welty actually slept with this guy. And
he's doing research.
Yeah, he starts reading everything Welty wrote, and he ends up in a way, falling in love with Welty. And to your point about AI, you know, really, the man who slept with Eudora Welty in this story becomes the narrator. Because I just really believe, T, and that the intimacy between a reader and a writer is, you know, one of the most intense experiences two people can have outside of and sometimes including sex. You know, I just think it's absolutely, and it is what I feel when I read Welty. I feel this intense bond with her, even though she's long dead. We didn't have much in common culturally. We have different ideas about religion. We obviously have different genders. I just, when I read her work, I feel like somehow we are one.
Yeah.
And that's what I was trying to get at in the story.
Could you read the last sentence, Miles?
Yeah, sure. Sure. So, just flipping.
Oh, it might be two sentences. Well, see what you think. Oh, maybe the last paragraph.
Yeah.
The page? What do you think?
Yeah. Let me see. So the narrator is talking about. So maybe I should. Okay. I'll just start. I'll read a couple of paragraphs. And so this man has gone through this experience with Welty, and.
Hey, you know what, Miles? Let's take a short break, and then let's pick up here, and we'll read come back on.
Great. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. You're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Living Writers today on the show. Miles Harvey is here with us in the studio. We've got Jason behind the glass. We'll be back. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, so glad you did. You've got Living Writers, and today Miles Harvey is here joining us. The book on the table with us, Collection of Stories, The Registry of Forgotten Objects. Miles, thanks for choosing songs for today's program. What did we just hear, and why'd you choose that one?
We heard a song by the Velvet Underground that is in the way that the Velvets and Lou Reed did turns this sort of idea of the ocean as being this beautiful seashore. I got to go to the beach in Florida, Jimmy Buffett kind of experience, to one of a completely ominous and horrifying, but also numinous in a way. And godlike. And I chose that story because there's a story called Beachcombers in Doggerland in this collection. Doggerland was it's now covered by ocean. It was the land between Europe and England in ancient times and inhabited by humans. Then they still find stuff. This story is about a family that loses their beautiful teenage son. He goes surfing after his high school graduation.
From the University of Michigan.
Yeah, and he just disappears into the ocean, and his surfboard disappears, and he's completely gone. And this couple comes back every year. My book is not just called The Registry of Forgotten Objects. It's about objects. And they collect beach trash and sort of try to puzzle it together into some understanding of what happened, or somehow he's going to return or send them a message. You know, and I think those of us who are of a certain age and are losing our friends or losing loved ones, losing children, I was just trying to get at this sort of sense of loss. And to me, the ocean is it's much more like a Lou Reed version of the ocean, of a place of danger, but also a place of sort of, you know, I just saw the seashore in this story as a vague dividing line between, you know, now and then, mm-hmm. Life and death, and somehow the day-to-day and the numinous. And
yes,
so
the liminal space, yeah, the thin place.
Yeah, yeah. So so that's what that story is all about. And it's this family is the one, many of the objects float in and out of my stories, and that's sort of the way they're tied. But this family, and particularly the lost boy's younger sister, who I have great love for, because I think she is completely lost in her own way, to have a family that obsesses on their lost beautiful son when their living awkward younger child is still stumbling
right
around. Yeah, she's sort of this broken person, but also
in her combat boots and leather jacket,
yeah,
on a Florida beach. I love that characterization.
Yeah.
True.
And she appears in a few of the different stories. I don't know if she completely, she's looking for a sense of self, I think. And I don't know if she quite finds it, but I think she gets close by the end of the book.
And speaking of these objects that you said connect and link the stories within the Registry of Forgotten Objects, the barbershop pole here is important as an object that then harkens back to the lead story.
Yeah,
in the collection.
Yeah, there's this wooden, old-fashioned wooden barbershop pole that is sort of the if there is a main object that comes in and out of the stories. And it plays an important role in this first story, which is about kind of the environmental meltdown of in the high plains, just an endless drought, and how people respond to that. And at one point, this barbershop pole gets thrown into the river and washes off on the day that the rains come. And then it shows up as this couple who have lost their son are standing in the ocean one day. It washes in, and the woman brings it in, cradling it like a child. And the man actually takes the barbershop pole and hides it from his wife underneath their floorboards. And he comes to understand that
in a box he built.
And he comes to understand that he just wanted to put his boy to rest. But the barbershop pole keeps showing up in different stories. I don't know why. You know, like, it's one of those things that, you know, you know, I don't know why I became interested. I think because there was a barber in the drought, and I just...
Yeah. Oh, what? And he reminded me, as you were speaking, of the Confidence Man.
Yeah.
Not the same, but he had that sort of charisma that he brought to that town as the weatherman.
Yeah. Yeah. One of my colleagues at DePaul, who I have a lot of respect for, as an expert on 19th century literature, which, and she said, you know, I think your book is about the fine line between a confidence man and author. And I'm like, yeah, maybe so, you know, right? Because I think there are these kind of characters do interest me. And at one point, there's a actual confidence man in another story, and one of his guises has been college professor. I couldn't help but put that in there, you know. So, these objects are really, they w- it, they were really important to me in thinking through how this collection was going to work. You know, I'd been publishing stories since I was in Ann Arbor many, many years ago, and actually getting them published in pretty good journals. So I knew I was a pretty good writer, you know.
Did you come here for fiction, Miles, fiction, or was there a nonfiction time?
Okay. I don't think there's a nonfiction program at this time. I think it's still just fiction and poetry. I could be wrong.
There's definitely a concentration in folks that are teaching it.
Oh, that's good. Well, that's great. And in any case, in my day, it was just fiction and poetry. But a lot of us, a couple of us were nonfiction writers, journalists, and went back to doing a lot of nonfiction. Michigan's produced some great nonfiction writers. Donovan Hone from Ann Arbor, who teaches at Wayne State, I did a reading last night at Literati, and he was there. And he's a friend at this point, but he's just a guy I just think is super smart guy. And in fact, the title of the book is kind of tangentially inspired by Donovan, because he did
The Duck.
Well, even before that, he wrote an article for Harper's many years ago, before I knew him, called A Romance of Rust. And it takes place in this area. Oh. And it's Donovan going around with his uncle to farm sales, who's obsessed with old objects. And I just remember Donovan described how this uncle would buy objects. And one of the kinds of objects that interested him were these objects that tools that no one knew what they were used for.
Right. Because they were that old.
Well, but they weren't that old. That's just the whole thing, T. Like, they were a couple of generations old.
Oh, but had shifted so much.
So much. And, you know, for those of us who are older, sometimes we recognize even now with our children or our students, you know, like you'll talk about, I don't know what, some object that was ubiquitous in your own childhood, and they won't know what you're talking about.
A telephone booth.
Yeah, and so the final story is this sort of post-apocalyptic story, where and that's the Registry of Forgotten Objects, where there's a registry in this sort of post-apocalyptic landscape that's just collecting forgotten objects, which are most objects in this world, that they just don't know what they mean, and including many of the objects from other stories, including the barbershop pole.
Yes. So, yes.
Yeah.
That has a starring role. A book of Sappho's gets tossed.
Yeah.
We can pulp that. I think that was the phrase from the bureaucracy.
Well, and of course, Sappho's already suffered that. We only know a lot of her work because it was discovered in an Egyptian, essentially a trash heap in the 19th century. This is how a lot of her fragments, because I think I'm not a Sappho expert, I should say, but I think there's only one completely intact poem of hers, and the rest are these amazing suggestive fragments, which to me are all the more beautiful because they aren't quite clear in meaning.
There's more space for the reader with the writer, like you were talking about earlier, that synergy.
Absolutely.
Where then the reader has, there's literal space all around the fragment for you to be with Sappho.
That's beautifully put. Yeah, that's exactly right. And so, in one of the stories, these Sappho fragments serve as kind of clues for a guy. And it's, in the final story, they're like, Sappho, we have no use.
It's grim. It's grim.
What is this? Pulpit. So, yeah.
So Miles, I think let's talk about how long it took you to collect these stories, because has it been in the making like 10 years? Because you said you've been writing since you were in grad school, but I'm not sure. Are any of these stories from that time in your writing life, or?
No, none of them are from that long ago. But there is this, I think, at least one story that's like 20 years old. And, you know, I just...
Which one is that?
The Drought, I think, is...
Oh, really? The lead story?
Yeah, yeah.
So interesting.
Yeah, and I, you know...
And a foreshadowing of other things that you...
Yeah, yeah. And I... So, you know, I just... at some point decided, you know, I'd always vaguely wanted to put out a collection of stories, but...
just vaguely wanted.
Well, you know, I mean, it's funny because, you know, when I talk about, like, this feels like, this doesn't feel like a side project for a nonfiction writer. It feels like the direct, oh, I sent a copy to Nick DelBanco, one of my teachers here and mentors, and I said, Nick, it's going to sound, because Nick's, in fact, just a prolific writer. So,
oh, he is so, he's written many books.
I think he's always rolled his eyes.
Yeah. And everything.
Yeah, yeah, he's got a new memoir that I'm really excited to read. In fact, I have it on me here in Ann Arbor. But Nick's very prolific, and I think he's always been mildly amused and irritated about what a slow writer I am. But what I wrote when I sent him the book is like, this is going to sound stupid, but this is a direct result of my experience here in your workshops. I mean, it's I didn't write the stories then, but it doesn't feel like this big jump. It feels like something, you know, I probably read more fiction than nonfiction, and it's, I love writing it. And you know, so I started just kind of, I had some older stories and I started, kind of trying to listen to them. And then I went on it. What's for me, or I'm a very slow writer, very slow thinker. Not, I would say I'm only smart in slow motion, but, I went on what for me is a writing jag. I probably wrote 6 new stories in the course of a couple of years, which for me is very, very fast and felt furious, in fact. And then I, you know, as I wrote them, I started seeing these, like I wanted them to be kind of one thing. I love story collections that are somehow vibrate off each other, the pieces. And there's different ways to do that. I mean, there's obviously the story cycle, Winesburg, Ohio, or Olive Kittredge, where they set it in the same place. That didn't interest me so much. I mean, I'm more interested.
But Michigan is all through this, not to argue with you, but you choose Michigan as like, it's reoccurring.
Yeah, no, and my life in Chicago is in there too. And I'm also just, you know, I think in general, for me, the Midwest is a place that is, Garcia Marquez once said, you know, people say you write magic realism, and I just write about Columbia. You know, he just was saying that that's the reality of my world. And I think Midwesterners often undersell the magic and the strangeness of their own world. And I tried to make some of these Midwestern landscapes appropriately strange and magical too. It's not, you know, the word magical realism is so overused, and it's not, you know, really, I don't know what I'm after, but I do, there's a kind of weirdness to the Midwest, among other things that I was trying to get at. And I love Midwestern landscapes. I find the Midwest so beautiful and so haunting, and I hoped I got that into the
you have Miles, yeah. You have. Let's take a short break, and then when we come back, we really will hear you read from the story we promised earlier, featuring Eudora Welty. I'm T. Hetzel. You're listening to Living Writers. Today on the program, Miles Harvey is here. We've got Jason behind the glass, and we'll be back.
They pulled around for the sailor, and they heard his tale of a world that was so far away, and a song that we'd never heard, a song of a little bird who fell in love with a whale. He said, you can't. Oh,
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Miles Harvey is here in the studio, the Registry of Forgotten Objects Stories, here on the table with us, out with Mad Creek Books this year. Miles, thanks for choosing some Tom Waits for today.
Well, I love that song. It's about, as you could hear, it's about a deep love between a whale and a bird, and the impossibility of that love, and even the impossibility of them sharing the same space. And I found that song so stunningly beautiful, and I think it's something that a lot of the characters in this book, The Registry of Forgotten Objects, feel is a separation. How do you? I talked earlier about this story where the dead son is somewhere out in the sea, and the living survivors are on the beach. I mean, that would be an example. But this story that we've also been talking about, the man who slept with Eudora Welty, is about how we bridge those divides. And like, this is about a love affair between a long dead writer and a living reader. And So I explained earlier that the narrator of this story, I'm sorry, I lost my place there. Radio land. The narrator of this story knows nothing about Welty at the beginning of the story, and because he becomes obsessed with the idea that he may have met someone who slept with her, or else someone who just made up this incredible story to play him.
On the train. Passing the time.
Yep. He starts reading everything Welty wrote and reading everything he can about her, and he ends up, falling in love with Eudora. Welty once wrote that the primary challenge of an author is, quote, to imagine yourself inside another person, a metamorphosis she described as, quote, making the jump. And over the years, I've gone from admiring her ability to inhabit the lives of fictional characters to feeling that the border between those lives and my own is increasingly porous, with all sorts of phenomena making the jump. Recently, for example, I was rereading her story, June Recital, when I came upon a passage about a funny, ugly doll named the Billiken, a good luck charm shaped like a grinning Buddha with a huge pointed ears that serves as the unlikely mascot of St. Louis University, the college that my 18-year-old son had on that very day decided to attend. A couple of months earlier, while I was finishing a short story about a barber pole that suddenly appears after someone's death, I happened to open my tattered copy of The Collected Works of Eudora Welty to page 102, a passage from Flowers for Marjorie, in which a man who, after killing his pregnant girlfriend and rushing into the street, spots, quote, a thin gray cat watching in front of a barber pole, end quote. And just now, while once again rereading The Hitchhikers, I became aware of something I had never consciously noticed before, that one of the characters sings The One Rose That's Left in My Heart, the same Jimmy Rogers tune I'd selected seemingly at random for a different story about a character who loves old-time country music. Mere coincidences, perhaps, but whenever they happen, I feel that both the shudder of recognition and the joy of being recognized, as if someone else is observing my life from the other side of the page. Now on the verge of old age, I've known many type kinds of intimacy, the complex pleasures of marriage, the endless anxieties and satisfactions of raising children, the bittersweet goodbyes with dying loved ones, and the enduring consolations of long-lasting friendships, including those with my graduate school colleagues from all those years ago in Ann Arbor. But these days, few human beings feel closer to me, to my heart, than the woman who once declared that her continuing passion as a writer was, quote, to put a curtain, to part the curtain, that invisible shadow that falls between people, the veil of indifference to each other's presence, each other's wonder, each other's human plight, end quote. Ah, Eudora, 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 in the end I can't tell whether the tale I've told is true or false, autobiography or fiction, nor am I sure why I bothered to write it down. All I can say for certain is that you've made the jump into me, and perhaps I've made the jump into you, quote, a shared act of imagination between writer and reader, as you once put it. And what you've taught me, sweet Eudora, is that this shared act is perhaps as close a relationship as two people can have. So come to me, my love. Wrap your arms around me as I sit at the piano. Kiss me on the neck while I play this song. Now this is how it is, Eudora. This is how it really is. And that last line is stolen from The Hitchhikers, a Eudora Welty song. A Eudora Welty song. The great Eudora Welty songs. Eudora Welty story. So,
Alan Nomak.
So the narrator literally sort of occupies the space of the story. So
yes, and it's that single last line too, as he's speaking directly to her to say this is. Is it true or is it not true? This is how it is. Yeah. It is true. This is.
Yeah, yeah. It's how it is in that. You know, and T, I know you wouldn't be doing the show if you didn't know.
Oh.
No. I mean, I have this rule, and in fact, most books I read, I end up following it, that I have to, if I love a book, I have to kiss it on the cover wherever I am. Like when I finish it, not all the time, but so not all the time. I don't have to, but like if I finish a book on the L and there's some dude smoking weed next to me and eyeing me funnily, I still have to take the book out and kiss it.
So I'm always, when you finish it, that final moment.
You get to that final moment. Yeah. That's my rule. Like if you love this book, show the book the love.
When did you start that, Miles? Like, how did that become? Because it's like a touchstone,
I don't know. I'm just, you know, like all people, I'm just such a weirdo.
Well,
so I was a book reviewer for a long time, and you'll see from my book that this isn't a good example, but I cannot write in books, although.
I can't.
Although I love other people's marginalia. I love it. I love when I come around. Because most of the books I buy are used, and I love when someone writes, Uncle Jim would disagree with this! ! In the margins or whatever. But I can't do it, and so I ruin books with Post-it notes. I have this whole system of Post-it notes, and so I don't know. I'm just very I fetishize books. I think like a lot of people who love books do. I always tell my adult children, like, there's more books coming into this house than I will ever read. And you can call me stupid, but I just like having them on the shelf. There's a magic to me. Leave me alone. A lot of them cost $3 and postage. You know, like, just leave me alone. And you're going to be stuck with it. I'm probably not going to clean this mess up. You can put it out in a trash bin, whatever you want. But, like, I want these books. And it's not that I don't ever sell off books, but...
Or give them away, to the right person.
Right. There's this whole traffic among book lovers of I lend you my book, T, and you say I'll get it back to you, and then 20 years later you look at the shelf and you say, you know, Miles Harvey loaned me that book 20 years ago, but meanwhile, you know, you've loaned.
Do I have any of your books, Miles?
Yeah, I think it all evens out because people borrow my books and then they disappear, and then I borrow other people's books and they disappear, and
it does even out.
There's a kind of nice economy to it, I think. Yeah. So,
while you're still in town, before you head back to Chicago, are you thinking of going to West Side Bookshop or Don Treader, over to Carytown?
Yeah, I love the book scene in Ann Arbor, and I have to go teach a class tonight.
Oh, wow! What's your class, Miles?
Oh, it's a really interesting class. It's an oral history class. With some colleagues at DePaul, I more than 10 years ago now, we started this weird undertaking called Big Shoulders Books.
Yes, I saw that in your
Yeah,
bio.
And our goal is to amplify voices of Chicagoans who might not otherwise be shared. So we started this social justice book publishing company, but we also, it's a kind of a publishing lab. We publish some very beautiful and very good books, and our grad students and undergrads are involved in the making of those books, but also involved in the decision making of those books.
So book arts.
Yeah, we have more than 100,000 actual hard copies
sent
in print.
Out to the okay.
Yeah, no, and you can also get it on ebook with
Big Shoulder Books.
Big Shoulders Books. The whole idea, it's just totally weird business model, but for us it works because we have funders who really support us. We give away all our books for free. But we never stand out on street corners doing it. You have to come to us and ask for the books, but we'll give them to you. So, the first book I did was with Big Shoulders was an oral history of street violence in Chicago, where we just went out for 2 years and interviewed kids in gangs and kids on the edges of gangs, people who lost loved ones, a lot of people who'd lost loved ones, but also the county coroner, trauma nurses, just all sorts of people who. We have a real violence problem in Chicago, and we put these together in a Studs Terkel type oral history collection.
Yes.
And it started as a documentary theater piece for Steppenwolf Theater and sort of evolved from there. And both with the theater version of it and the book version, the Chicago Public Library set up a tour of libraries in violence-plagued neighborhoods, and we thought it. Steppenwolf has, toured all over the world, but never toured Chicago. And we thought no one would show up to these little performances, and people showed up big time, and it was a good thing we had.
And what year was this?
So the book was out in 2000. I think both the play and the book came out in 2013. It was a while ago.
What good work?
But 6 months apart or something, and. Then with the book, it was the same. The book was great fun because we brought actors to read from the book, and the people we interviewed, the narrators of the book. Just the first event we did at this library was it was on the kind of near west side of Chicago, and most of the kids in the library that day, most of the people listening were from this alternative high school of kids who, a lot of whom were probably in gangs and. When the reading was over, the actual people from the book were on stage, one of whom wrote this chilling narrative about getting out of his gang and how hard it was and how he feared for his life. And in fact, it was an act of courage that he was on stage. But anyway, these kids just bum rushed the stage to get the autographs of the actual people, their actual stories in the book.
Yeah, definitely.
And so that's the way we did it the rest of the way. And it was just so cool. Just this sort of shared joint storytelling, community storytelling where, my students and I definitely played an important role in it. But we collaborated with everyone who's in the book, they read their narratives before they went in the book. And
yes, good practice.
I was worried as a journalist, it's kind of standard oral history practice. Yes. I've since learned I was as a journalist.
Not as a journalist, but as, yeah.
Yeah, I was a little skeptical, but my grad students were like, no, if we're going to claim these people's stories, we have to let them read their stories.
Yes.
And what was interesting to you is just how many... people like what great storytellers people are. So these kids who were, no high school degree was saying, hey, here's a detail for you. Do you want to know, what kind of gun I had? Like here's some concrete details for you. The exact kind of things I try to get my undergraduate and graduate creative writing students doing.
Yes.
So, so there, I don't think there was anyone who absolutely turned us down, but a lot of people added great details and really became part of the storytelling. So it was a great experience, and we've done a bunch of books since then. I'm working on another oral history project. We just produced a book by my colleague who edited it, Chris Solis Green, a wonderful Chicago poet, and it's a bunch of immigration stories told through objects. I love this book for reasons that listeners will understand.
Yes.
it's just, you know, it's all these immigrants from all over the world just telling their story through one object.
Yes.
And it's just it's a beautiful book. And our books are beautiful objects. This is full color, a gorgeous. We hire a professional designer to do the books because we just think our books are free, not because they're worthless, it's because they're priceless. So,
Yes. And folks can write to you or absolutely. Is there a storefriend?
Yeah, no, it's bigshouldersbooks.com. You just go on if you want hard. If you just look up Big Shoulders Books, I wonder if we're .com. I guess we are, yeah, because I think it's a. You can either download e-versions, we're especially interested in getting books to teachers and to, you know, like How Long Will I Cry, the oral history of youth violence, for years was used. I think it's still used in some prisons, but it was used in the Cook County Jail with young offenders as a kind of, like, it was really cool. They invited me one time as they were reading the narratives. And a lot of times, you know, these kids who had committed gun violence were reading the stories of people who lost people to gun violence. And it was a powerful thing. And that book, there's 50,000 copies plus out there. That's kind of our best seller if we sold. But all of our books are wonderful. And I urge listeners to check out Big Shoulders Books. I think it's like such a great passion for me. And it's, you know, I think, as I'm going on in my career, it's one of the things I'm proudest of. You know, I've had, you know, one of my books was a bestseller, but it's not that I'm not proud of that, but this sort of working with my students, but also working with people from all over the city is, and to kind of try to tell stories together is an amazing experience.
Let's take a short break. We'll be back with Miles Harvey for the last part of our conversation next, The Registry of Forgotten Objects Stories, the book on the table with us. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, Miles Harvey is here in the studio, The Registry of Forgotten Objects Stories. Thanks for picking that song, Miles.
Oh, yeah, that's by a great Chicago band they sometimes still play out, but it's Dolly Varden. I think everyone in their life has a couple of bands. You just wonder why they aren't famous. And Dolly Varden is one of those bands for me. A great Chicago band. This couple, and they combine country and rock and soul in this amazing way. I just think they're wonderful. So check out Dolly Varden.
Oh, and yeah, and shout out to Chicago, because I know I keep steering us back to all like the Michigan connections in the Registry of Forgotten Objects, and you even get down to the Treasure Coast of Florida with the lost surfing son who disappears in the ocean. But Miles, I wanted to ask you I was going to ask you about St. Anthony, but I think I want to ask you, what are you working on now? What's your current project?
I don't have a current project.
What
exactly.
does that feel like to
well,
you then?
Well, because, you know, T, I got to say, like, I, you know, again, I'm just not the, well, for one thing, and it's an honor to serve in this way, I'm the chair of the English department at DePaul University, which is completely improbable thing. I'm unqualified in like 99 out of 100 ways.
I bet everyone loves you, Miles.
I think I stay out of their hair because I'm just incompetent enough not to think I know too much. But I was actually, I don't want to really talk about it, but I've just, part of my time in Ann Arbor has been doing some research, and I don't know, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do next, and I'm trying, I think a lot of, you know, I think it's kind of a waiting time for a lot of writers I've been talking to. I don't know if it has to do with the weird times we're in but it's also the publishing industry is in tricky shape. I had on the King of Confidence, I had this wonderful editor who was super old school, this guy, Ben George, who I learned so much from at Little Brown. And, you know, in one of the many purges in the publishing industry, I'm not sure what he's doing now. Maybe he's with a different publishing house, but he got purged. So, you know, this editor who I was really looking forward.
Editors are hard to find, the ones that you.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I think it's such a tricky and an important relationship with an editor. On my first book, The Island of Lost Maps, I had this guy, John Karp, who's now running Simon Schuster, who is brilliant. And then in my next book, John bought the book, but then moved on to something else. So I was orphaned, which again, you know, I don't mean to sound like
a painter.
Yeah, painter in a savage land, which was, I don't mean to sound like a whiny writer, because I've been so lucky, you know, I've been really just so lucky. And that's a lot of anyone's career. But being orphaned and having an editor who's not hugely interested in the project, who's just been assigned it, you know, that's a harder thing. And so, you know,
there's so many doubts as a writer often and sometimes you need to know that you can trust the person who's supposed to be looking at something that you may or may not have a lot of distance from at that moment.
Yeah, no. And I just think there's a lot of doubts in the publishing industry in general. It's not that we're not publishing books and it's not that people don't love books, but I was with some writers last night who were describing poets who were listing poets who appeared on the cover of Time or Newsweek. And there are.
Oh.
You know?
And shout out to Keith Taylor.
Yeah, shout out to Keith Taylor, who was bringing that up. You know, that's just not going to happen now. But I think that's also probably, like, I just think with partly with this media landscape that makes truth porous, also splinters our attention about literature and makes many literatures, which is awesome. But, you know, I don't know. I think it's a hard time in the publishing industry, too. So
are you throwing out a challenge to all poets? Someone get on Time Magazine.
Yeah, man.
Prove Miles Harvey wrong.
Oh, no, I'm totally pro-poet. You know, in fact, about a decade ago, I gave a talk at a writer's conference. And the theme was, we're all poets now. Like, it was talking about the industry. And, like, to me, like, I will take your advance, big New York publisher. I've had three nice experiences with big New York publishers. I am not, I just want to be clear, New York publishing houses, I will take your money. But I just think there's something liberating. All my poet friends, who are many, you know, they don't even think about money. They do it because it needs to be done and they love it. And that's why you do this stuff. That is exactly why you do it. And it's what lasts and what matters. And so, as I say, I look forward to my next project. And if I get paid a good chunk of change for it, but you know, the Registry of Forgotten Objects, I spent more on my wonderful publicist who you dealt with, independent publicist, than I got in the advance.
Oh, and shout out to Cheryl.
Yes, Cheryl Johnston, the great. Yeah.
Miles Harvey, thank you so much for today's conversation. I've loved it.
Oh, T, I have loved it too. You're great at your job, and thank you. And Jason, thank you for spinning some great tunes.
It's a good day. It's a good day, Miles. Today on Living Writers, Miles Harvey, The Registry of Forgotten Objects. I'm T. Hetzel. Thanks a lot for listening out there. Until next time.
Wait.
Here's the report from the world of sports on WCTN.
Hello, you are listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor, 6 o'clock, Wednesday, January 22nd, which means it's time for the Daily Sports Report. You heard the jingle. I'm Alex Miller. We got a full panel today. Zach Warshaw, TJ Fossmeyer, Charlie Mitchell, Andrew Pipta. And I don't know, we don't really have anything planned particularly on the docket. We're largely just going to run around the horn, fire off some takes, have a fun half hour, and not to catch anyone's pants on fire, but TJ, I'm going to start with you.
All right.
What's something that's been running through your mind, a take on the sports world?
You know, with the college football playoff now ending, and I love that they expanded it. You know, regardless who won Ohio State, whatever, they had an easy path. I think they expanded it too much too early. I think they should have gone to 8 before going to 12. I think some of those teams that got in didn't deserve it, or at least if you're going to move it to 12, you don't give the conference championships byes. You just put them either automatic qualifier and you seed them like the rest of the field. I think there are changes needed for the playoff. I think this was a great college football season. Just need to make some tweaks. I don't know if that's a hot take, but I think that's just a take.
I mean, I would counter argue with, I mean, even if the current playoff situation, I mean, the season played out the same, I mean, Ohio State probably still wins an 18 playoff. And I agree that it should have began at 8. But at the end of the day, I mean, they're not going to revert it back or downsize it. I think commissioners already said that they'll keep the buys, and the only thing they're probably going to do in the future is expand it. I don't love a 14-team playoff. I think 12 is a good amount for where, like, maybe not at a four, but kind of agree with you for the most part there.
I mean, I think, you know, money-wise, it's pretty clear that that's the motivating factor.
Right.
They're not going to shrink this thing. And as for this year, I mean, in a way,